It's okay. I think I shot a little bit too high. You know, I was talking about political philosophy. So, you know, I have my master's, so you know, can't expect. So today we want to really finish this Haggadah, or at least almost finish. I don't know if we can finish it entirely. Oh yeah, thanks. Thank you. Let's see if we can figure out where we got up to here. I have a little. I made a little sign here, so let's see if we can find. Oh, the Omar, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman. So we're on Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, towards the bottom of the Amud, and let's see. It's about five lines up from the bottom. It should say Kol Dayan. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4. Five lines up from the bottom. So it's interesting, what we have embarked upon now is an entire series of memories, of statements of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni in the name of Rabbi Yonasan. So that's a tradition. He says, Kol Dayan Shenotel Mizeh Venosein Lazeh. In other words, if he gives the wrong judgment, and he's going to take money out of Shimon's pocket and put it into Reuben's pocket when Shimon is really not liable, Shalom Kiddin, it's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu notel mimenu nafsho. It's as if the Dayan took the nefesh of the person who he found liable, and therefore his nefesh will be taken. So when you judge, when you're going to play the role as a judge, it's a pretty scary enterprise, because you might end up losing your life. That's how dangerous it is. I was always wondering, you know, the halacha says you're not allowed to put your life into danger, so I was wondering if you're allowed to be a dayan. Okay, nobody laughed at that, but I meant it seriously. That's why you didn't laugh. Shenemar, the pasuk initially says, "Al tigzal dol, don't steal from a poor person. Ki dol hu, he's very poor. The al tedake oni b'shar, and don't put down the subjugate, so to speak, lower the level of the poor person by stealing his money." Now, it doesn't say anything in the pasuk so far about the fact that you're chayv misa for such a thing. You lose your nefesh. So for that, the Gemara has to quote the next part of the pasuk. It's actually the next pasuk, and it says there, ki Hashem yariv rivam, God is, so to speak, fighting on behalf of the poor people. V'kava es koveyem nafash. In other words, what Hashem is saying is he's going to take the nefesh itself, and that means that by stealing from a poor person, you really are guilty to such an extent, Hashem is going to fight the battle on behalf, Yariv Rivam, on behalf of the ani that was cheated, and it means that the thief is going to be, his nefesh is going to be taken from him. Now, in this case, the thief is the dayan. Now, one question that I want to raise with you as we go through these Haggadahs is, with all the harsh words about the punishment for Dayan, that Shedon Shelo Kiddin, are we talking about a Mezid or are we talking about a Shogeg? What's your inclination? I think we're talking about a Shogeg, not a Mezid. I'll tell you why. It's very hard for me to believe that a Dayan would deliberately do such a thing. I mean, that's the lowest of the low. To steal from the Ani, again, if you're talking about, you know, a person who's bribed, you know, that's something else. You know, they bribe the judge, so obviously he's gonna adjudicate in favor of the plaintiff at the expense of the defendant, because the plaintiff is paying him off. But I don't think that that's what we're talking about. We'll soon see that Rav himself, the great Rav, he's probably the greatest Amora that we have, he says about himself that he was afraid to judge because of this member. I don't think Rav suspected himself of taking bribes. The Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman Rav Yonasan, again the same link, the same tradition. We olam yira hadayan atzmo ki lucherev munachas lo ben yirei chosov. He should view it as if he's like sitting on the edge of a sword. And it means that again, I think it's the wrong judgment. I think we're talking about a shogeg, not a mazid. If he makes a toast, is gehenem psuchalo mitachtov. He should see it as if, you know, the gehenem itself is open in front of him. He's about to fall into a very deep abyss.
Like tov shebarofim, the same concept of also. It's also isn't that same expression used by the rofim?
Right. Yeah. So now, where is the pasuk that indicates? That the cherev is munachas lo ben yirei chosov, which means in Hebrew he translates as puranus mezumenes lavo miyad. You know, the punishment is right there. You know, the sword is already there between his legs, so to speak, between his thighs. Or alternatively, the pit of Gehenna is open below him. He's going to fall right into the pit. And as a pasuk in Tehillim, he quotes him, "Mishod aniyim mi'enkas evyonim ata'okum yomar Hashem." So, in order to see the pasuk, we're going to have to make a tremendous effort here, and we're going to have to turn the page. So that's on Daf Zayin Amud Beis. Shenema, the pasuk says in Shir Hashirim, "Hinei mitasos l'shlomo." For those of you who have the custom, the Sfaradim are very makpid about this, to read Shir Hashirim on Friday night, then you'll know this pasuk. Shishim giborim saviv lami giborei Yisrael kulam achuzei chorev melundei melchama ish harba yirechom mipachet balelos. Now the word lelos here is symbolic of a very dark place, which is called Gehenna. And the pasuk is interpreted the following. The mitaso shel shlema is a code phrase for the Beis HaMikdash itself. And a Sanhedrin would establish their courthouse right there in the middle of this complex called the Beis HaMikdash complex in Elishka, which was called Elishka Sagozis. The Sanhedrin, the members of the court, the highest court in Israel, are called Giborei Milchama. What does it mean, Giborei Yisrael? They are fighting the battle of Torah, meaning they're trying to understand the Torah. They may disagree, and therefore they'll have arguments back and forth. And then the pasuk says that kulam achuzei charev mulum de melchama, but ish charbo al yirecho. The charev is on the yerech. The yerech is the thigh of a person. So it turns out that when the dayanim are sitting down to din, it's as if there's a cher of some sort that's stuck there between the erichayim. That's very scared. And when the Torah says mipachad balelos, what is the atmosphere, the state of mind that the dayan finds himself in? He's in a state of mind of pachad. He's afraid of gehenom, which in this pasuk is called laila. So laila here is a symbolic representation of gehenom. Now, Rashi and later the Marsha embellishes on this. They're bothered by the word shishim. It says 60. Now, if this pasuk is really a reference to Sanhedrin, how many members of Sanhedrin were there?
71.
So why the number 60? So Rashi only says lavdafka. You'll see that on the top line of Rashi, but the Marsha says the following. We never find lavdafka with regard to the number 60. 60 is a very special number. There are endless number of drushes of Chazal on the word 60. He says the following, that Enochinami Shishim means 60, but then there's another phrase in this pasuk, Migi Borei Yisrael. And he says that if you count the number of words in this pasuk, you'll come up with the number 11. So he says that the Gibore Yisrael is a reference to the additional 11 on top of the Shishim Giborim, and 60 plus 11, therefore 71. To make a long story short, the Marsha takes this drasha very seriously. He's challenged to come up with a rational shot that the number here reflects the number of the Chachamim that sat in the Beis HaMikdash on the Sanhedrin HaGedolah. Now, here in the Masifta, he quotes the Yad Ramah, one of the Rishonim on Sanhedrin, who says that this pasuk is not talking about the Sanhedrin, but rather about Shlomo HaMelech, about Shlomo HaMelech himself. And he was a Dayan, and he was Dan Dinei Torah. I mean, there's one very famous case where Shlomo was judged. Remember the baby, right? And he was mitzarif with him 60 Talmidei Chachamim. And why? Because he felt that if he could gather together such an amalgam, such a large convention of Talmidei Chachamim, surely if his inclination would be in a certain direction and he would be erring, he'd be mistaken, they would set the record straight. So they were like the Cherev Ne'utza Ben Yerech Hosea. They were there sort of like as the Cherev, you know, to sort of scare Shlomo HaMelech to make sure that he would get everything right. Now, it says here in this pasuk that Shlomo HaMelech, when he was sitting in judgment, was afraid as if there were 60 Yiborim that were surrounding his bed ready to kill him with swords. And why was he so afraid? And the answer is, the Chazal say, Mishum Chashash Midin Gehenom. In other words, he wasn't really afraid that these people would kill him, but that they were representatives of the divine court, the heavenly court, and they might bring about a situation in which he ends up in Gehenna. By the way, there's a whole discussion here, not for us now, about the Girsa, where the Girsa is Ben Yirei Chaim, or Ben Atzavar, maybe it means on the neck, wherever these swords were. So we're finished now with an entire string of Agadatas of Rabbi Shmuel in the name of Rabbi Yonasan. Now we go on to other Agadic statements about judgment, about the judges. Dorash Rabbi Yoshaya, the Itema others say Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak. Now if it's Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak, so I'm not sure if this is the famous, I don't know, there are different people sometimes with the same name, so I'm not sure, but in any event, my dechsiva pasuk in Yirmiya, Beis David, ko amar Hashem, dinu laboker mishpat, judge during the morning hours. The Gemara is going to try to figure that out, why judgment is not during the morning hours. V'itzilu gazul miad oshek, and make sure that your goal that you should set for yourself, your vision, your mission, is to protect and save someone who is trying to steal money from someone else. And now Rav Yoshe darshens this pasuk in Yirmiya. He says v'chi boker donin v'chal yomei donin. Why does the Torah attach din to boker, to the early wee hours of the morning? That's not so. The whole day, even until shkia, is kosher lodum. And this is a Mishnah later on in Daf Lamed Beis. Now it's true, and the Gemara establishes this elsewhere in Shabbos and in Ksubas, that they usually sat during the morning hours. They finished davening shacharis by the sixth hour, and during the morning hours, Beis Din would sit while in the Beis Hamikdash the Tomid Shel Shachar was brought. But nevertheless, why is the pasuk emphasizing boker? Now, can anybody tell me here? I'm trying to quiz you. You know, I'm guilty of doing that, so you'll be mocha me for quizzing you. But what does the word boker actually mean? I mean, we translate it as morning, but from an etymological point of view, what is the shoresh of the word boker? Unless you, every word, excellent, levaker. Well, no, levaker means to visit, but that's not the relationship to boker. Levaker means something else. What?
Inspect.
Okay, I would have used a different word, but maybe yours is better. I would say to discern. The reason why boker is called boker is because it's a time when there's plenty of light, and if you show me two things and I compare them, I can discern, I can distinguish one from the other. So he says the following, Ella, what does this mean? In baruch ha'adavar kiboker. Right, boker is a catchphrase for clarity, because that's what it means. Levaker means to discern sometimes nuances or subtle differences, which you can do when you have the clarity of the mayor, of the sun that's giving the light. And this is a message to the judge that his din should be a din of boker. What's a din of boker? It's a din of bar lecha. In other words, you and I might have said that the judge might have made a decision because he's 80% sure. Maybe he's only 51% sure. He thinks that this is the right judgment, but he's not really convinced. And this drasha of Rabbi Osha is coming to tell me that if he's not clear, it's not bar lecha kiboker, then al yomruhu. Omrehu means to issue a proclamation, a ruling. And when it's bar lecha hadavar kiboker. But in lav, in the absence of boker, al tomrehu, don't say it. Now, I'm not sure what this means, because are we saying here that every single judge, whenever he gives a decision, he's absolutely sure, he's certain beyond the shadow of a doubt, of the true nature of his verdict? I mean, can't there be a little bit of, you know, gray area in his decision? And apparently, again, I can't tell you what the poskim are going to say here, because I don't see any tzion here to the Rambam, unless there is something here. What would be in that case where he has a little bit of doubt, just a drop of doubt? It sounds like he should recuse himself. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Rabbi Yochanan Mehoch, I could derive the same conclusion from a pasuk in Mishlei. Emar l'chachma achosi ot. Somehow I think we discussed this in the past. Mm-hmm. That chachma is compared to a sister. And why? In bar l'cha davar ke achoscha she asura l'cha. In other words, you have no doubt that you're not allowed to have relationships with your sister. So the sister relationship is like a classic, a clear idea of an iser erva. And again, there are deeper layers of meaning here in this Gemara by equating Chachma with Achos, but right now on the superficial level, Chachma has to be clarity. Then Omrehu, then you should paskin the din. But in Lav, if it's not clear to you, like the fact that your sister is Asura, then you should not issue a ruling on the case. Here, we have an insight of the Aruch Laner, and if you like the insight, then I'll tell you a little bit more about him. He was a very, very unique personality. He writes that why did this pasuk in Mishlei choose Achos? There are many other Isurim, he said, that could have been good candidates that are very clear. And he says, based on a Gemara in Makkos, that the Torah went out of its way to mention that the Iser of Achos applies even in a half-sister. In other words, Bein Achos Me'ovid, Bein Achos Me'ima. The Torah never writes that there's an Iser Erva with your sister who's a full sister. But what's the answer to that? Why didn't the Torah? Because it's Kal v'chomer, right? If I can't have a relationship with my half-sister, certainly I can't with my whole sister. And not only that, my whole sister is also my half-sister, if you follow me. He says the answer is that the Torah wanted to teach us a principle, that's a sugyat makkos, called Ein Mazhirin Min Adin, that we don't derive punishments based on a Kal v'chomer. And we're going to need a special Yalfusa to prove that he gets the punishment even if she's a full sister. So this pasuk achoso is a message to us that things have to be absolutely crystal clear. We could rely on our intuition, but that's not good enough. We need absolute clarity. And otherwise, you know, we can't derive, you know, jump to conclusions based on our logic. Now again, you might ask me, what's the havamina that a person would not be chayv kares, for example, if he has a relationship with his full sister? And Amos Hirvin Adin, I can only tell you, there's a famous Marsho says that maybe the punishment, every punishment is a kapara. The Torah didn't want to let him get off easy if he violates a more severe crime with a lesser punishment. He says, Umikan Musar Haskel, says the Aruch Laner, L'dayon, Shalo Yismach Al Daito, he should never rely on just his judgment call. El Yivares Hadin, go through the poskim, and of course the Torah and the Mishnais and the poskim, and come to an absolute clarity that this case fits the din as it's described. Once you have the absolute clarity, it's similar to Achosa. Now, just a word about the Aruch Lanner, because I'm always fascinated by this. The Aruch Lanner was a German Jew, a genius of geniuses, just amazing his creativity, and he actually belonged to that branch of Judaism that believed in studying secular studies. And he studied philosophy in university in Germany. That's where he was from. He was a German Jew. He had to leave in the year 1820 because of anti-Semitism. So German anti-Semitism is an old story. It's almost, but not as old as British anti-Semitism. Anyway, I have an axe to grind there, but the Brits are horrible. But anyway, so the Aruch Lanner had to terminate his study in the university, study of philosophy, because of anti-Semitism. Who was his greatest disciple? Anybody know?
Hirsch.
Excellent. Rav Shimon Shofar Hirsch. Now he quotes the Birkei Yosef of the Chidah, that the reason why the Pasuk in Mishlei mentions Achoso is in order to teach you that Adayin Bo Lesser, V'Eilo Lahachmir, V'Lesser Misafe, Achi is Barlo Adova. In other words, the Birkei Yosef is assuming that this Pasuk is not just limited to Adayin and Dini Momenos, but it also applies to Horos Isa Vehete. And you might think that if a person comes and asks a question, I might as well tell him it's awesome. Why? Because I have a suffix. I don't know if it's awesome. So I'm going to tell him it's awesome. Right? I can only gain by that. I can't lose by that. Name. The Torah says it's got to be clear like Achoso. And the reason why Achoso is chosen, because Achoso is a case of an Isur. And this pasuk wants to cover even a case of an Isur. Oh, Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, Asara sheyoshvim b'din, kolar tolui b'tzavar kulon. Even though there's a massive amount of judges here, I mean, you have 10 judges that are sitting, but nevertheless, they still have to realize that a kolar is some sort of a sharsheret barzel in modern Hebrew, which means it's a chain that's made of metal, and it was used to tie together two different things, and it's kind of like handcuffs almost, and there's a headcuffs in this case, and when there's a chasimas hadin in the case of a kingship back in the old days, what they took the kolar and they tied it around the neck of the person who's condemned to death, and that's how they took him out to death. So this is a frightening vision here, that even though you have 10 judges, you know, each judge might feel, you know, it's not my personal responsibility. I'll take the rap for what I say, but you know, it's the other 9 judges. Nevertheless, each judge has to realize that there's a kolar shel barzel that is around his neck, that is totally is suspended over his neck, and he will be punished severely if he makes a mistake. So even though the 10 judges, each one has to take this very seriously. So the Gemara says pshita. Why should we think that just because there are 10 judges on the court, therefore that alleviates the responsibility on each particular judge? Now, the Aruch Lanner again is going to ask a question, be bothered. He wants to know, why is this so pshita? I mean, there are 10 judges. Psychologically, you know, if you do something, imagine you're a surgeon on a team of, you have a team of 10 physicians on the same team. So, you know, you don't have to take this so seriously. There are another 9 physicians making the decision. So he says the following. Medubar, the case is the following. Miut hiskimu batoyas hadin. In other words, that although the judges were divided, they were the proponents of the decision, then there were the dissenters, and the dissenters were, of course, in the miut. Nevertheless, they, at the end of the day, although they really dissented, they agreed to the decision of the court. So to speak, they were mevatel themselves in front of the rov. If they insisted on maintaining their position as dissenters, they will not be punished. But if they change their decision because they think, let the Ribbono Shel Olam blame the rov, I'm just adding on my vote, then that's where the Torah is teaching me that they're going to be held responsible and taken to task. Now here, the Masifta quotes the Birchas Avram. My son Baruch actually learned by the Birchas Avram. He's a Rebbe in a very famous yeshiva here in Beit Fagan called Kol Torah. Have you heard of it? If you didn't hear of it, you're not listening to the Kol of Torah. Anyway, so the Birchas Avram says the following. There's a Tosis in Baba Kama that says that when Beis Din paskins a din based on Rov, the Miud is batel to the Rov. And it's considered as if all the judges in unison made that decision and handed down that ruling. And based on that Tosis, he says, we can understand why all the judges are going to be held responsible, even those who dissented to this opinion. Because they are considered al pi halacha to be part of the decision. They're batel to the rov, which means they too have to take this whole thing seriously. They can't just say, well, I'm not responsible here because there's a rov. The ein l'dayin l'sheves elin dayodim sheish l'smok shelo yetzei mitshel tachas yodam. So it's interesting because even the dissenters are considered batel to the rov, and the decision now becomes a unanimous decision al pi halacha. Therefore, they have to make a very cautious decision when they join the court. They have to look around and see if the other judges are bar samcha. There are people that we can rely on, so that there won't be a michshel. I don't want to be part of a beis din when I have suspicions that this beis din is not on the up and up. They're not excellent in their Torah knowledge. So by joining up with this beis din, they are really taking responsibility for the ultimate ruling handed down by this beis din. Even if they'll dissent and object to the decision, they are the miut. But the very fact that they linked up with this if those judges are bad, why did you link up? You didn't do your due diligence to find out whether these judges are really reliable or not. In any event, the Gemara now interprets that this statement of Rabbi Shuba Levi is a big chiddush in the following scenario. Ella l'talmid hayoshev lifnei rabba. So you remember we spoke about an apprentice. He's learning how to judge, so he sits on the right side of his Rebbe, and he tries to watch and he learns. And now he sees that his Rebbe made a mistake. If he's quiet, if he withholds that information, it doesn't point out to his Rebbe that there's a mistake being made, then because of his silence, he will be punished. And therefore, kolar tolui b'tzavra kulam refers kulam not just to the judges, but even to the disciples of the judges. Now the Gemara tells a story about Rav Huna. Rav Huna ki avi osi dina l'kame. People came for judgment to Rav Huna. He was the Gadol Hador in his day. And what he did was michnef umaisi asora rabbona mibei rav. He went to the Beit Rav, to the Beis HaMedrash, and he gathered together 10 other rabbis to join him in his judgment. Why? Omar, he declared, Ki hechi delimtien Sheba mikeshura. Now, Sheba is called in modern Hebrew Nisoret. I think it's called in English sawdust. Otherwise, the word Sheba might refer to a kisam. Kisam is a little splinter. What do you call it? Right. We use it as a toothpick, but in its original form, it's like a piece of wood, a small slice of wood. And these fall down from the korah. Korah means the beams, so they had wooden beams. And what he was afraid of is that maybe one of these splinters from a beam would come shooting down, mikashura, kashura is the beam, and limtiyein, it will fall on his head. And a person can get very seriously injured if something flies from the rafters and hits you in the head. And what Rav Huda was saying was that if I do this alone and go in as a Yachid Mumchu could judge as a lone ranger, then all the punishment will be on my shoulders. However, if we share the burden and I have another 10 judges, all told we have 11 judges, the number has to be odd, is that I'm only going to get 1/11th of the punishment. And we'll see the same thing in Rav Ashi in just a moment. But first I want to share with you the Marshal. The Marshal says that a korah, a beam, is very heavy, and one individual alone cannot carry it. It weighs a ton. But if you gather together an entire entourage of people, then together they can divvy up the weight, and they're able to carry it. He says, "Hakoved mischalif ben kula." Everybody, each individual is only carrying really a small segment of this gigantic, heavy korah. So to hear, if the dayan is going to join with another 10 judges, and the ultimate decision will be made by all 11 judges, then each judge is only taking upon himself 1/11th of the responsibility, hence 1/11th of the punishment. The she'iltos, that goes back to the time of Rav Chaigon, he adds another twist to the word korah here in this context. He says that the depths of the din, of the judgment, which requires amkus, is called a korah, it's called a beam. Kishiyadunu biyachad v'chol echad yomer esfaroso v'chaveri yachkoro l'hoven es omek dvarav yavi kol echad kisem echad min ha-korah ashi agiu l'korah shlema. He says that a korah is made up of smaller parts. You bring together these parts and then you pulverize them or through some process of adhesion and you end up with a korah. He says that's what din is all about. Each one of the judges is, you know, who expresses opinion is going to be interrogated, so to speak, by the other judge. They're going to raise points and clarifications and objections until finally the Omek HaDin will be understood. And the Omek HaDin will be understood as a joint effort of so many and so many different Dayanim, individual Dayanim. And so too a Korah is the product of a joint effort of all these little splinters or toothpicks, if you want to call them. Rav Ashi, now here's an indication that this Gemara is talking not only about din in the classic case of dini momentus with litigants, but even horas isavahetu ki avi asi treifa solakameh. The animal looks like a treifa. He finds after the shechita a certain puncture in one of the organs. He now has been asked to express his psak as a chacham as to whether or not this is indeed a treifa. And this could be a, you know, for a person who owns such an animal, or even a shochet who sells such an animal, this could be a major loss. So what did he do? Machnif, remember the word machnif we had yesterday, it means to join together. Umaisi luhu, but he brings lekulu tabchei demasa demachsia. There was a major metropolis in Babel called Matamachasya, and there were 10 Jewish butchers in the city of Matamachasya. Now, Matam Chassia was made up mostly of Iranians, non-Jews, but the Frumma Yidden moved in. And again, there were all sorts of issues there. You know, the local population was not necessarily happy about this influx of Jews. Right? So, if you know what's going on in Palm Beach in Florida, you know, the Hasidim are all now buying homes in Palm Beach, you know, the local... Anyway... All right, this doesn't seem to interest you. But in any event, I'm very fascinated by this. You know, when Hasidim descend upon an area, it's not only Hasidim, by the way. Even if it's modern Orthodox, you'll still get the Teaneck, New Jersey, which is a major citadel of modern Orthodoxy, was the subject of tremendous controversy. I don't know about Passaic also. You know, they wanted to build a mikvah in Teaneck, and it was zoning issues. Right?
I remember that.
You remember?
Yeah, I was there for that.
And I'm wondering about Passaic. You know, Passaic was a pure Goyish town. I remember Passaic, let's see how many years ago, I was in Passaic 50, 55 years ago, I was in Pesach. There was one Orthodox shul, and you can count the Frum Yidden and that shul in one hand. And I'm sure the Goyim were not so happy. Today there are, I think, 22 shuls in Pesach.
Oh, yeah, and growing.
And growing.
Pesach Clifton,
right? Pesach Clifton, maybe. And be that as it may, you know, the Goyim get very nervous. So here, imagine, in the city of Mosa Machasia, a major urban metropolis, and there were 10 Jewish tabachim. And Rav Ashi called them all together for a convention, a butcher's convention. And he showed them this animal, whatever it was, this bull or this cow that was shechted, and he wanted to see if they would come to some sort of a general agreement about this animal, whether it's a treifa or not. He felt that the shochtim, the tabachim as we call it, were bekiyim. They were absolutely experts in the laws of treifas. So he didn't want to rely on his own judgment. He would rather pass it on to the experts. And together, there would be some sort of consensus as to whether this animal was a treifa. Omar, and when he explained his actions to his students, he said, "Kiechi so that the limtiyin shiva mikushva," which means that the pieces of wood that'll fly down for the beams will go in many different directions. They won't all fall on my head. Ki asar Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. Omar he darshened in the name of Rav Nachman Bar Cohen. You know, I never knew the name Cohen was such an old name. Ma'idat Siv, what does the pasuk mean in Mishlei? Melech b'mishpat yamid eretz, v'ish trumos yarasena. It's interesting. The first part of the pasuk is talking about setting something up, which means being creative and constructive. And the second part is talking about yarasena, to absolutely destroy something. He says that the reish of the pasuk is talking about a dayon hadome l'melech, a king. In Talmudic literature is a paradigm of someone who makes his own decisions. Again, you could have a more humble king who will take counsel with other members of his cabinet, but that's not the way Chazal used the term Melech. Melech is going to make these decisions on his own, out of a state of conviction. He thinks he's great. And the Dayan should also have something of a Melech in him. She'eino tzarch l'klum. He really doesn't have to call up any other judges and get their opinion on the case. You know, today in many different fields, and I think it's a great thing, people, even if they're experts, they will confer with others to make sure that they're on the right track. So for example, in medicine, there are certain standard procedures. So they want to know in every case, what is the standard procedure? The Dayan, on the other hand, the way the Torah sees it, at least according to Rav Nachman Bar Cohen, has to be independent. He should not depend upon others who are greater experts than him. If that's what he has to do, then this is the wrong business for a good Jewish boy of that sort. If he's a baki, he knows the dinim, he's full of chachma, he's like the melech, who can make his decisions. Also keep in mind, a melech is usually very wealthy, he has the king's treasury, and he doesn't need anybody to help him raise funds. Is then, if the dayan fits that description, that profile, yamid aretz, his dinim are considered aretz. Aretz, in this case, is a pseudonym, is a code name for emes. Emes is called aretz, because the pasuk says, Emes mi Eretz Titzmach. God took Eretz Emes and he brought it back, brought him down to earth. And Ma'amidim, here the apostle says, Yamid Eretz. Ma'amidim es Eretz. So as they keep the, you know, we think it's, what's his name? Not Hercules. But what's the name of the guy who holds up the globe?
Atlas.
What's his name?
Atlas.
Atlas, right. Atlas. We think it's Atlas. You know, we the answer is, that, you know who's the real Atlas? Not Atlas. The real Atlas is the Dayan, the judge, who is judging properly with Emes, Yamid Eretz. He's the Atlas. He's keeping the world afloat. Now keep in mind that Okay, we actually spoke about Rav Ashi before. I just want to point out here that Rav Ashi, in the previous statement in the Agadah, he was the Rosh Hashiva in the city of Masa Machasya. I forgot to mention that. Okay, that's not important for us now. But what's important is that this Dayan, in order to be Mamed Eretz, and he has to be self-reliant. And Tosfos, Dibra Maskil She'eno, points out that later on, in the case of a Maisa in Bein Nisia, they set up a Dayan who was not a Baki, and it was a very, very bad situation. So the Dayan has to be a Baki. That's Gemira, Smichta, Ugemira. He has to really know. Now, what's the end of the pasuk? It says, Ish Trumos Yarsena, Ve'im Dome Lekoen, Shemachazer Bebeis Hagronos Yarsena. A Kohen is not self-sufficient. He's totally dependent upon the Truma that's being divvied out. Now, if he has his buddy, that's called Makiri Kahuna, that always gives him truma, he doesn't have to run around to all the grunos, all the thresholds, threshing places, and find the kohen. But if he's not such a popular kohen, maybe he's a little shy, he's going to have to run around from one Beis HaGoren to the other Beis HaGoren until finally he can collect enough truma. He says that a Dayan, who is not self-reliant, he doesn't have the knowledge, he's going to run around and ask everyone. You know, he's going to send out a message on Facebook, you know, what should I do in this case? And in such a case, he's acting like a Kohen who runs around from one Beis HaGoren to the other. That's not a good situation. Yersen, at the end, he's going to destroy the land because he's going to make mistakes in judgment. So even though you might say, well, he knows who to call, like they used to, the joke was that when you got Smicha, you got a klaf, and then you got the you know, Moshe Feinstein's phone number on the back of the klaf. So that's not the ideal situation for a Dayan. Maybe it's good for an American rabbi, so you can always call Moshe to get the final answer to this question, but a Dayan has to be self-sufficient. Now the Gemara is going to tell us a story here about the house of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Bein Nisia it's called. Now Bein Nisia refers to the people who were in charge of the house, you know, different kinds of servants and so forth. Maybe includes also the students. Anyway, this whole group of great Jews, Okme, they set up a Dayan, but unfortunately, the Lo Avi Gomir, he was not a Baki in the Halachas. So they appointed a Dayan, and he was not a Baki. Amru Le. So they turn to Yehuda Bar Nachmeni. Now, it's not clear to me. There are two things that I'm confused about here. Maybe you can straighten me out. I don't understand exactly what the connection here is between the fact that the Bein Nisia were guilty of appointing a judge who wasn't up to par with the story here about Yehuda Bar Nachmeni. I'm not sure. Secondly, I'm a little bit confused as to whether Yehuda Bar Nachmeni is saying something pejorative about his Rebbe Reish Lakish. So let's go through the story. Maybe you could help me out over here. What was the position, what was the job of Yehuda Bar Nachmeni? He was Miturgamenei de Reish Lakish. You know that in those days they didn't have microphones. So the Rebbe, instead of straining his voice, like some of us do today, and trying to make sure that the guy who's sitting all the way in the back hears him, he would whisper into the ears of a Meturgamon, and the Meturgamon was like a foghorn. He would scream out whatever he heard from the Rebbe. Very often he would hear it from the Rebbe in one language, and he would translate it into the vernacular. So let's say Reish Lakish would speak in Lashon Kodesh, and Yehuda Bar Nachmeni's job was not only to project his voice, but at the same time, to translate the words of Reish Lakish that he heard whispered in his ear into Aramaic, the local vernacular. Now, as you and I know, whenever you translate something, something gets lost in translation. So in order to guarantee this, we appoint a Meturgamon who not only has a loud voice and a good sense of hearing, he has good ears, but he also has to be quite a scholar. because he has to really understand exactly what his Rebbe is saying. There are nuances and differences that are hinted at in the language. So when he projects, you know, the Torah that he heard from his Rebbe, he better understand the Torah well. Now, Amru Le, the Anshe Beis Hanasi, turned to Yehuda Bar Nachmeni, and they say to him, Kum Aleha Biamora, stand next to the judge, and be Doresh Bitzibur Bikol Ram, whatever this judge whispers into your ear, project it out loud. Oh, I think I begin to understand. Now I got it. This is a trick. The Chachamim in the Beit Nesia knew that they had been mistaken. They made a real boob by appointing so-and-so as a dayan. They knew that he wasn't up to par. So when they told Yehuda Bar Nachmeni to listen to the ears of this dayan and project his Chachma, you know, transmit his Torah, they knew that this dayan would have nothing intelligent to say. So come, Yehuda Bar Nachmeni gets up, Gachin Alei, right, that's what his job was, he bends over to put his ears to the mouth of the Dayan, and sure enough, Lo Amalei Midu. You imagine the busha here, but he had, you know, in public, he had nothing to say because he really wasn't the scholar. Pasach, so instead, Yehuda Bar Nachmeni decides to give his own drasha. See, I mistakenly, when I learned this myself, I thought, and now I see I'm correcting my error, but you didn't hear my error, so I shouldn't even share it with you. But anyway, what I really thought was going on here is that Reish Lakish was half asleep, and he didn't whisper anything into the ears of Yehuda Bar Nachmeni, so Yehuda Bar Nachmeni took over for his Rebbe, and he said a whole drasha. And I couldn't figure out why is that connected to our story about the Beit Nesia, that they appointed someone who wasn't up to par. And secondly, how could Yehuda Bar Nachmeni darshan in such harsh words against his Rebbe Reish Lakish? No, he's darshaning, again, not, he's doing it diplomatically, not directly, but by hinting, against this dayan. This dayan may have paid a lot of money to get his appointment, but he knows nothing. Pasach, so Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachmeni opens up his drasha with the following pasuk. This is in Chavakuk. We're going to see different parts of Chavakuk today. Hoy Omer le'etz hakitza. Hoy, woe to a person who speaks to a piece of wood and tells the wood to wake up. Does anybody have a clue in what context Chavakuk is talking about? Why would you speak to a piece of wood? Exactly. Who spoke to wood? It was Avodah Zarah. He's talking about a pestle that was made of wood. Hi, are you going to talk to this piece of wood and hakitza and wake it up out of a state of slumber? This is his facetious way of making fun of Avodah Zarah. There's one thing that the Torah is in one area in which the Torah is absolutely in favor of late tzonis. Late tzonis is usually not a good thing. Here in the ELC, I think it's a good thing. But late tzonis is not a good thing. But against Avodah Zarah, late tzonis is a mitzvah. Uri li evan dumam. Are you going to wake up an inanimate stone? And now, the pasuk all of a sudden shifts its theme. Who Yoreh? Yoreh is a decision that's made by a judge. Well, we've been talking about Avodah Zarah. Well, why are you addressing a judge? Hinei hu tofus zav v'kesef. Now he's going back to his discussion about the idol worshippers. They make their idols out of wood, out of stone, out of gold, out of silver. V'chol ruach ein bekirbo, but there's no life force inside of any of these idols. But now, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Nachmeni is using this pasuk, and he expects his audience to understand that diplomatically, he's referring to this dayan. This dayan, who's supposed to be whispering into his ear, and he's projecting his words of wisdom, but he's not saying a thing. this Dayan is like a piece of wood. Try to wake him up from his slumber, or a piece of a stone, you're just wasting your time. And if you're going to ask the Dayan, wake up and give me a psak, he really is totally at loss. And that's what it means, hu yoreh. Can he give a judgment? He's asleep. He has no intelligence. And then the pasuk says, hu tofezov v'kesef. You know how he got his appointment? Yeah. Probably it means he paid it off. He paid it off. He bought the position. If you have enough money, you can buy any position. V'chol ruach chachma einbo. He has no shmek, no spirit of wisdom. That's our Dayan. He can't darsh it. So it's a funny thing that the Bein Nesia wanted to undermine this Dayan and finally get rid of him. And what they did was they asked Yehuda bar Nachmeni Kaviyachal to be mitargem from him and to expect hearing from his mouth, from this Dayan's mouth, words and pearls of wisdom. They knew full well that there weren't any pearls of wisdom to be had. But what they did was they relied on the Chachma of Yehuda bar Nachmeni to make a statement in a very dramatic way. It's what's the word I want to use? It's dressed up and hidden behind a pasuk that's addressing Avodah Zarah. And then we have a pirush of Mitzudas, of the Mitzudos in Chavakuk, and he says that the sin of a false judge is equivalent to Avodah Zarah. We'll see about that a little bit later. The Asad HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we para mi ma'amidin, God will in the future punish those who set up this Dayan. Maybe they got paid off major money. And by the way, this touches on the whole issue of Gius Safim of what's the word I'm looking for?
Fundraising.
Excellent. Because sometimes you can find someone, I'm not saying any of us would be guilty of this, but if you're fundraising, you go into the living room of a very wealthy guy, and he says, he sort of floats in front of you a very hefty sum of money, a check, made out for $1 million. And as he's waving it in front of you, he tells you what he expects from the institution. And he says he wants it to be boys and girls learning together, or he wants it to be, a certain political bent. And he makes all sorts of conditions. And basically what he's saying is, in Yiddish we say, it's if you're taking my $1 million, I'm going to tell you how to run your institution. And unfortunately, that's the tragic end of many Torah institutions. The conservative movement in America was very, very wealthy at a time of when rabbis were being paid bakhus. And the greatest challenge of a good Orthodox rabbi was getting won over or bought by the conservative movement. And there were some rabbanim who just couldn't be omed in it. They needed money to support their wife and their children. So they took jobs in conservative temples with mixed seating and with, a parking lot, open parking lot on Shabbos and so forth and so on. Now again, conservative means many different things in many different places. I don't want anyone to walk out of here and say, I'm making a blanket statement about everything. In the yeshiva in Chicago, there was something called traditional rabbis, which I think was men and women sat separately without a mechitza. I don't know, all sorts of lumdus nuances, exactly what's Orthodox, what's conservative, what's traditional. In Chicago it was a big, big to-do. It was kind of traditional movement. But very often these deviant movements had lots of bucks, and they could buy rabbanim who were otherwise Orthodox, because the great temptation. And in some cases, it was a matter of starving. Some of the rabbanim was starving. My father, when he had his first position in New York, he was being paid $25. Finish it?
A year.
No, a month. Not a year, a month. $25 a month. And not only that, he didn't even take the $25 a month for himself, because the previous rabbi had died a young man, leaving a wife and young children. My father insisted that some of his salary would be earmarked for that wife, for that almana. Because in those days, the shuls didn't have those kind of contracts, you know, where they take care of the almana if the rabbi dies.
There were some yeshiva that mocked the rabbis to go into conservative.
You're giving Russian tables here. You don't know. We don't want to mention any by name. Yeah. But there was. I know of one particular yeshiva. You're probably thinking of a different yeshiva, where it was pretty classic yeshiva. Now, I'm not talking about Yeshiva University, which was a little bit more open-minded. You know, they say, I don't know if it's true, that the Rav Zichron Prophet gave a heter to one of his talmidim to take a conservative temple for 1 year if he wouldn't take a salary. And the condition was that he would only stay on after that year if they would agree to put up a mechitza. The kachav. Now again, you could walk into that synagogue today, and I'm talking about a story of 50 years ago, and look for the mechitza, you probably won't find it, but it's there. they had to build it in a way architecturally that you can't even see that it's a mechitza. It's like the hefshech of different planks of wood that are there aesthetically. Anyway, but that was an issue. Now, a dayan, you know, he's not worthy of being a dayan, but he pays good money. And that's when the institution of dayanus goes all the way down the drain. You may remember that we had a long discussion about the fact that God is present during din, during judgment. And therefore, the judgment is called Hashem Nitzav Adas. It's like a mini Heichal of the Beis HaMikdash. But Hasmi Ponov indicates a destruction, and the reason for that destruction is because it's a punishment for those who destroy the Aretz, and those the destroy Emes, and that those are these false judges. Now, unfortunately, the history of Klal Yisrael is full of very dark episodes of this sort. Even amongst Nevi'im, there were Nevi'im who were bought off, and they were not true Nevi'im, and so forth. The Marsha interprets the word has, not the way I did, but based on our parasha in Shlach, means b'loshon shesika, where a memes al dmamas churban. You know, the most frightening thing about churban is it's silent. You know, you go to a place after Churban, you don't hear a word. You can hear a pin drop. That's what the Rav told us, that after the destruction, he knew a Jew who went back to his hometown in Vilna, and he stood at a shul. Apparently Vilna before the Holocaust was full of shuls. And he stood there, and he was hearing the noises that he used to hear in his childhood before the war. You know, it was a robust davening, and it was absolutely silent. He says the silence was deafening. And then he heard a cat. And at that point he broke down, because that cat was his mother's cat. And that cat used to come to the shul on Yom Kippur. I don't know how this is possible, but the cat was coming to look for the Jews. And it was absolute destruction. So that's called Has. Has mi ponov kolokos. Omer Eish Lakish. We're going to have to end, so let's just read a few more lines. Omer Eish Lakish kola mami dayon sheino hogun. Anyone who's in charge, who's guilty of appointing a judge that's not worthy of judgment, ki ilu notea ashera. Remember, we discussed before the Pasuk Chavakuk that seems to combine a judge that doesn't know how to judge with Avodah Zarah. Here's the basis for this Reish Lakish's statement. And he says that this Asherah, which is a tree that's being worshipped, was set up in Israel, in Eretz Israel, and now a person who's a Dayan, that's Eino Hagun, was set up as a Dayan, he was appointed. Shenemar, it's like planting an Asherah. Shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha. In other words, make sure that you appoint the right judges, reliable judges, honest judges, knowledgeable judges. And then afterwards, Samachle immediately says, "Vlositalacha Asherah Kaleitz," which is the Isur of planting an Avodah Zarah tree. And in between, in the space between the lines here, you just put in the words, and if the Shoftim and Shoftim that you appoint, Titilcha, are not worthy, then you are violating this Isur of Asherah. And here the Rishonim and the Mefarsh want to know what is the logic that underlies this equation between a Dayan Sheino Hagun and an Atze Ashera. So here I'll quote to you a Gemara in Tainus. The Gemara in Tainus says, Ki Adam Eitz Hasad, a man is compared to a tree. And that's a pasuk in Dvarim Perkchav. So Rabbi Yochanan in Tainus, Tafzain, he says, Ki Adam Eitzu, what does the Torah mean when it says Adam Eitzu? Ela Mishum should never be Eitz Machal, Ki Mimenu Tochal Vio Solo Tichros. That you're not allowed to destroy a tree, that's called Valtashkis. If let's say it's an Elon Strak, it doesn't grow any fruits, then the Torah says, also sashchis, you're allowed to destroy it. Ha ketzad. And what is this a symbol of? Im talbid chacham hagun hu is mimenu tochal, then you could eat of the fruits of his production. Im talbid chacham hagun hu, also sashchis. And just like in the case of the Elon of Asherah, which is designated for Avodah Zarah, you have to destroy that tree, so too, you have to weed out these kind of Talmidei Chacham Sheino Hagun, that they really do not live up to the expectation of what a Dayan has to be. So if I can borrow your pencil here, Asher, we're up to Omer of Ashi, am I right?
Yeah.
Omer of Ashi. And this Agadata will take us one more day, I think. It's midway through Daf Ches, and then we get back to the halachic discussions. Now, by the way, just as you leave, I want to point out that the Dayan here in Reish Lakish is called Eino Hagur. I would have anticipated it should say Eino Baki. But I think what he's saying is that Dayanus requires not only intellectual attributes and capacities, but also moral attributes. And if the Dayan is not known for being an upstanding moral person, he's called a Dayan She'eino Hagun. Okay, then, anyone who wants to learn a little Chumash, a little Parsha, I have something very interesting on Tzitzis today, and that'll be at 10:40. And in the meantime, thank you very much for a very productive week, a lot of Agadita, and have a great Shabbos. Okay? And let's get rid of all those Meraglim, and we should only see the good in Eretz Yisrael. Thank you.